Mortal fear is as crucial a thing to our lives as love. It cuts to the core of our being and shows us what we are. Will you step back and cover your eyes? Or will you have the strength to walk to the precipice and look out? Do you want to know what is there, or live in the dark delusion that this commercial world insists we remain sealed inside, like blind caterpillars in an eternal cocoon? Will you curl up with your eyes closed and die? Or can you fight your way out of it and fly? With this quotation from an imaginary 1977 Rolling Stone interview with mythic filmmaker Stanislas Cordova, Marisha Pessl begins Night Film, her second published novel. Night Film follows a broken journalist's investigation into the haunted life and death of Ashley Cordova, the mad director's beautiful daughter. It begins as a mystery with overtones of dreamlike horror. It flickers and dims and deepens into a study of people who burn too brightly, burning up the souls around them until their aftermath is a legacy of ashes. It's about art that goes too far and the fanatical religious passion such art can trigger in those strangelings who are attuned to its frequency. It's about the nature and function of fantasy, the damage done to the ties that bind by those who walk between the worlds and march only to the devil drums of their own terrible destinies. It's about witches and tricksters, idols and fans, readers and authors, the hand that shapes and the eye that sees everything, sovereign, deadly, perfect. It's a book about us, and a book about itself. The book before us is Night Film. I'm Jason Squamata, and this is Book Circle Online.
From the Library of Maria Menounos, this is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Welcome back to BCO, my darling shut-ins. Thank you for stepping into the circle. I have once again assumed the form of Jason Squamata, and I am joined in the circle by...
Pat Janowski.
And...
Christy Gray Lovato.
Now, before we dive into the inky shadows of this haunted book, let's talk about Marisha Pessl. Her father was an Austrian engineer. Her mother was an American homemaker who read most of the Western canon aloud to little Marisha and her sister, and enrolled the girls in lessons for writing, painting, jazz, and French. She went to a prestigious private school and graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Barnard College with a degree in English literature. I've been dying to get this book on the slab for our dissection, ladies. This book is right up my dark alley. A perfectly imperfect mashup of horrific mystery, cinemagic history, supernatural thrillerism, and literary shimmer. I loved the way it used faked photographs, internet mock-ups, and an iPhone app to lend depth and reality to the novel's backstory, while also tainting the world around me as I was reading. McGrath, the ethically shaky anti-hero, finds that he's living in a Cordova film. So does the reader. I'm still in one, I think. Slaughter my lamb, Marisha. How did you guys like it?
Well, Jason, hilariously, on the heels of your reading all of that business there, I have to say, one of the things that happened to me when I was reading this book is that I found it reading it to myself in your voice. Hmm. It has the prose, the ideas, they have a weight and a heft and a style. There's this dynamic quality that is so much like all that stuff you were just saying, but just in how you said it.
Oh.
It's true.
I'm moved. Thank you. Thank you, Pat. Yes, I take that as the highest compliment, but go on. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry, Pat.
But mostly, to me, it's the thing that struck me was it's about living life to the fullest. Mm-hmm. But not phrased like the cliche that I just said, or marching like to the beat of a different drummer, or mm-hmm. that cliche either. It's basically pursuing your passions with a focus and a purpose and an energy, and I found that to be very, very inspiring.
Sure. I mean, that's the standard that Cordova, this director, who's the core of the mystery that he, like, bids everyone in his world to like, live up to. And in a way, as much as he seems to be steeped in shadowy darkness, the book seems to be imploring us to do the same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Whether in darkness or not.
Yeah.
Whether it leads you to darkness or wherever you find yourself.
Right. Indeed. Christy.
Well, I have to say, this is a book that snuck up on me. I thought, you know, when I started reading the book, through McGrath's journey, we explore all of these horror tropes sort of dancing within the films of Cordova as he sort of explores them for his own research about Ashley's death, but also as he investigates further and further into Cordova's life. And I was thinking, this is really corny. These are all things that we have heard before, seen before. And then maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, I can't remember what happened. The cat jumps off the counter. The next thing you know, I am like up peeking through the curtains. I don't know what's going on, but I am terrified. So it works. It's effective, and it builds the way that McGrath sinks deeper and deeper into the world of Stanislaw Cordova.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I hear that. Well, and I think, and it's interesting in the way you talk about the kind of tropes being hit on, that there's like there's a postmodern quality to the story, in that Cordova, this mysterious director, he's this collage of all these facets that we would ascribe to great directors that we know about. He's Kubrick, the great genius who does these tormented allegories of the human condition, but super secluded and just, you know, considered the supreme artist by all around him. He's David Lynch, and that he's, you know, his stories are cryptic and ambiguous and leading you to these dream-like places where you're searching for love and amidst the harrowing of hell. He's a Coppola, and that he has like this family of fabulously beautiful and elegant people around him at all times. And Dario Argento, which, by the way, while I was reading this, I came across this book about Dario Argento, the great Italian horror director.
Right, the gore fest.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah, and he does. I mean, his films are super gory, but they're steeped in this elegant stylishness. Mm-hmm. But this book is called Profondo Argento. And it's lavishly illustrated with these amazing critical exegeses of all his films. With it, like, it seems like a quarter of the book is given over to a study of Asia Argento, his beautiful daughter, and the lead actress in many of his films.
Oh,
yes.
How interesting!
Yeah,
so like an allegory to Ashley.
Well, yeah, I'm reading this book. I felt like not. I mean, obviously, you know, Marisha Pessl is aware of Argento, but I felt like she had actually looked at this book.
Totally cool. You
know, yeah.
How amazing for her to have intimately reached into your mind like that without even knowing it.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Yes, 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 that power. But yes, well, and just to wrap that up, though, I feel like by having all those bits and pieces of all those other directors spliced into this character, like, Cordova is the idea of a film director. Mm-hmm. And he's this, like, archetypal figure. So in the same way that McGrath, our lead character, is this kind of, like, he's a cliche in his own way, this kind of, like, cardboard cutout or this clip art of the journalist who went too far, or the journalist on his last legs kind of going into this world.
Who needs to redeem himself, maybe.
Yeah.
Or who needs to just go through the horror that is his life and come out the other side somehow.
Yeah. And it felt like he's a mask for us to wear to go into this. There are like all these kind of like naked tropes and very allegorical, you know, kind of modes, like, that are just doorways through which we encounter something that is, it's all more than the sum of its parts, basically.
Well, you say that these naked tropes, though, and drawing back to what Christy had said about it sneaking up on you, what's cool about the horror in this book is Marisha, actually, well, it's McGrath, too, just hints at the gore. I think you mentioned it, you said something about the dissociative horror of the situation, not knowing what's real and what's not. And that's, I think, what creates that specific terror in you. You're, you know, you're the worst. The devil on the one shoulder says, all of this is true. Mm. All of this is horrible. Uh-huh. While the angel says, well, it could be a logical explanation for everything.
Right.
You know, and in the middle of the night, the devil's the one who's going to get you.
Right. And you know, you don't know because McGrath doesn't know.
Right.
Until the end, which maybe he begins to find out, but you don't know if he is a hero. The people who work with him certainly think so, but you know, through his films, his fans see, and the actors who work with him see that he brings them on this sort of hero's journey through the darkest places. And
Cordova does.
Mm-hmm. Cordova does. And that no one, that it brings them to the brink of like absolute destruction and reveals their true nature. And once they come out of it, they are not the same. The characters in the film, the actors that work with him, the people that interact with him in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And Scott McGrath, the journalist, can't find anyone. Initially, not only anyone who's willing to talk to him, but anyone still in the world in which he lives who has brushed up against Cordova and still lives here.
Right. Well, and the more he steps into darkness and kind of lets go of some of his preconceptions, we see these people kind of emerging from the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that seems like a natural process. But, of course, as we go, McGrath starts feeling like he's in a Cordova film. We, you know, we start questioning the reality of everything, especially in retrospect. I mean, you get, like, as we move through the reveals, you look back and this stuff that just seemed, you know, gratuitously weird or,
the
you
club
know.
The in Long Island.
Yes. Right?
Yeah. There's this incredible thing where there's the sex club that's maybe connected with Ashley called the Oubliette, and he has to sneak in through this, sneaking along the beach at midnight.
With the waves threatening, crashing.
And then climbing up a rickety staircase and sneaking in. And there's this, all this strange, like, gender-bending, Trump-loy menace going on in there. And he has to flee away as the tide's coming in, running along the beach, and the waves are crashing up against him on the rock. And I'm like, I have that nightmare all the time. Okay, maybe not, like, the sex club part.
The secret sex club and the rickety ladder?
Well, if I had a dime for every time that happened. But you know, the running along the beach as the tide comes in, that's, like, the first foray into the horror trope of that, like, building sort of menace.
Right. No, absolutely. And also, I think I felt like there's an additional, like, you know, level to that. What with I've read interviews with Marisha, and or do I refer to her as Pestle?
I don't know. I kind of want to say Marisha.
Oh, let's say because she feels like a friend.
She calls her Ashley.
Totally.
Although Cordova is Cordova.
Right. Yes. Cordova. Okay. I'll call her Pestle. But so Pestle, she you know talks a lot about Kubrick in her interviews about who you know the main inspiration for Cordova was.
Cool.
Yeah. And so I couldn't help in the Oubliette, in the sex club scene, I couldn't help thinking of Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, it's you know, in the wake of its release as Kubrick died, and it has all these apologists and all these people have tried to explain to me how it's an important film that fits perfectly into his oeuvre, but I remember watching it. I mean, that movie, like this whole build-up to this impossibly decadent society of impossibly wealthy people and the filthy things they would get up to in a zone where no one would judge them or, you know, there's no surveillance by the little people. And you finally get to that point in the film and it's like Bob Guccione. It's not even Bob Guccione.
It's a big nothing.
It's like the Playboy Mansion. Yeah. It's oh my God. So there are three old men who are fondling a model on a pool table? A pool table?
I don't know.
The outrage.
Horrifying thing I can think of.
Well, no.
Bunch of rich people in a room.
Uh-huh.
Just together.
Together, yeah. Just
in general.
In general.
Yes, beyond the reach of the scrutiny of the rabble. But and so that, I mean, it's kind of a side note and not exactly germane to
now,
the velocity of the
now
story.
Now, you recalled all those great directors that that Cordova seems to be an amalgam of.
Right.
And that's something that comes in again and again in the book. She reveals just enough about things, like about the movies, and she drops enough reality in there. That we can't be sure if things are real or not in our world, let alone the world of the book.
Yeah,
You know, I found myself looking things up. That was this? Did this really happen? Was that director really a person?
Right. And there's and that's, I mean, an amazing aspect.
Well, it makes it fun.
It does, because there's like a whole world here. Mm-hmm. And I guess in her composition of the book, most of her time spent in the book was world building. She spent a couple of years creating this whole filmic history for this director. I feel like she knows the storylines of all those films.
Right? But, she's written all those films.
Yeah, but for all intents and purposes, yeah. And she,
well, the book is sprinkled with those icons, and you can go and the webpages.
Right, yeah. There's that amazing aspect of it where there's like a feature that you, with your magic future iPhone, if you have one, you can click onto pages of the book. That, because even like peppered in, you know, anyone, you folks at home, if you're flipping through this this wonderful tome, you can see that interspersed with the bits of narrative text, there's this kind of multimedia stuff happening with all these photographs and all these, you know, web pages.
It's super fun. You're reading the web pages, which is what we do. We go and look at what celebrities are doing.
Right. And the audio interview with the copycat killer from one of Cordova's films.
Yeah.
Really unnerving.
Right, yes, yeah. So there's an additional level. So apart from, like, what's on the page,
right,
occasionally you'll see this icon of a bird in flight, which, you know, which refers to a symbol system in the films of Cordova. But you can click on, you can take a picture of that bird with your phone, and it's going to lead you to this whole secret world of additional material. You get to see trailers for the films. There's a poster, a beautifully designed poster.
All the posters for 15 films?
I think 15, yeah.
And I think Cordova is all of those directors, but he's like the archetype for all of those directors. It's just, he came after them. He is this, in the beginning of his career, he is a cult filmmaker who has a moderate following, and he makes these films that are incredibly dark. And I've read a lot of interviews leading up to this review, and he's been compared to everyone from Hitchcock to, as you said, Argento. But then by accident or by design, falls in love with this beautiful Italian heiress who mysteriously dies, and he is left with an unlimited fortune.
This is Cordova. So he happens to have...
He's beholden to no one. Yeah. No investors. No, he can do whatever he wants artistically.
They say that the key element to being a great artist is having a trust fund.
Well, yeah.
And here we are. He's set up.
But also he can remove himself from the world. He doesn't need to sort of operate.
Pander
to anyone. He lives in this sort of bohemian daydream out in the countryside.
Right, where he films all of his movies.
Right,
On this estate, which is like the Coppola mythos, isn't it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, and I mean, I would argue that it's like the greatest inhibition and the greatest death that can befall an artist is having the trust fund. In my view, like, you know, he wants those resources. He marries this woman because he's in love with her.
Right.
All of a sudden he has these resources, and his work gets darker and darker and more dangerous and more urgent, because with all these resources, he's trying to put people in the desperate situations that he endured, in which he had to, like, find some meaning and impose some meaning.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one interpretation, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you don't know. No. The implication is that...
I mean, that's a like I said, an interpretation.
Right, yeah. And the book is, like, riddled with these ambiguities. Everyone is just kind of a, you know...
Well, except for the, like... And you were talking about this... we discussed this just a little bit before we got on the air, which is... not a good idea, but
yes.
Let me see if you can recall. It was something about, you had said something about like this Nancy Drew type plot that's on top all this stuff.
Yeah, to me, I mean, that was, we discussed, you know, and I appreciate the kind of slight postmodern sheen it has, where Cordova is the idea of a director, McGrath is the idea of a world-weary journalist. But to me, you know, what seemed to be a flaw, not so much in retrospect, frankly, but in going through the book, what seemed to be a flaw was that McGrath, he bumps into Hopper, who's this James Dean, you know, Hardy Boys, boy investigator kid, and Nora is the spunky, scrappy coat check girl who's going to be the Nancy Drew.
Your code right here.
Yeah, and they're going to, you know, solve these mysteries, and it just seemed like Cordova's world is just this yawning abyss of mysterious darkness and horror, and it just seemed kind of like a very light and almost flimsy
to lead you into this these characters.
That's true.
That tell this luscious backstory.
Uh-huh, right.
Well, and the implication that, you know, you don't know. And as McGrath gets deeper, he does not know if these films are staged or if Cordova puts these actors into these circumstances mm-hmm. where they are really being pushed to their limits. For example, the son, Theo. There's this part of the book where Theo has an accident while they're filming a scene of someone being horribly injured in the back of the car.
And Theo is Cordova's older son.
Theo is Cordova's older son. And right. Theo has severed three of his fingers.
In real life.
And runs onto the set wanting someone to take him to the hospital. And instead, Cordova swaps him out for the actor in the scene and makes him shoot take after take.
Running to the car, bleeding.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, this
bleeding.
Is very real.
Well, and the he wants to capture that like growing
terror.
I mean,
the kid could have bled to death.
Right.
Absolutely.
And if they had taken him to the hospital, he probably could have had his fingers reattached. But,
exactly.
But the implication is that all of his films are like this. All of his films are these people being put in extraordinary circumstances. And it lends itself to McGrath's confusion about whether he is kind of slipping into that world. And he's looking for cameras. He doesn't know. And so for me, that Hopper-Nora thing, right up until the end, it totally felt like a setup.
I
expected them
to be
to
actors.
Sort of reveal. Yeah,
yeah
that
right.
they were not.
Well,
Cordova
put
were.
Me in that.
Yeah. Well, you know, and like I said, in retrospect, you haven't gotten to the end of the book. You know, this is something I'm like arguing
well,
with and
there
fighting.
Are, there
well,
are
true. Well,
six
getting,
or seven or eight false
well,
endings.
Getting
to
the serpentine bolus of endings at
yes.
the end of it.
Yeah.
I like, you know, I felt like to me that like it actually works. My main problem
yeah.
with it actually ended up working because
right.
it was evocative. It was like Twin Peaks
mm-hmm.
where you know, like you have your clip art FBI agent
uh-huh.
and these are the teenage kids who are really worried about their dead
Jason's
friend.
Jason's making evocative robot
yes,
movements
yeah,
right now.
Yeah. Not that
for,
it, you know.
For our radio listeners.
And yeah, they're just these like kind of cutout people who, you know, kind of play up the artifice of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And they get more real as they go because they're steeped in this darkness. But yeah, it just kind of, it calls attention to the artifice of the whole thing. So, yeah, so you're off the hook, Miss Pessel, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Right, and leading to this climactic sort of, this nighttime raid on the Cordova estate.
Right.
Hopper and Nora and McGrath, who quickly becomes isolated and ends up going on this maybe, most likely, drug-induced sort of dark night of the soul through all of the Cordova film sets, which are still intact on
right.
the estate.
Yeah.
With all of the props and every sort of every detail is
still
there.
And that is in so many ways a climax, you know, to this thing because like
one
with,
of them.
Well, yes. Yeah, but to me it's like it's not even like towards the end.
No,
it's just sort of like beginning the kind of passage towards the end of the
right.
book. But it's the whole book imploded into a microcosm
mm-hmm.
where, you know, it's almost...
Yeah, you don't know what's real. You don't know if the props that are there on these sets...
Uh-huh.
So McGrath has possibly been drugged,
mm-hmm.
And he's rushing through. He's looking for... or is he being chased? I can't remember.
Chased by shadowy figures.
Chased by shadowy figures,
right.
exactly.
And dogs.
That's right, because he's made his way onto the Cordova estate
right.
through mm-hmm. the labyrinthian security systems.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds himself going from set to set of all the different movies, and there's
right.
the artifacts from the movies.
Yeah.
Like the briefcase that's behind
right.
the bed. Is that the
right.
thumbscrew one?
Right.
And you don't know if that briefcase was always there on the set.
Right.
If some fan placed it there,
yeah.
put the thing in it that rattles, you know, that thumps threateningly. Who knows? It's and neither does McGrath.
Right, right. Yes, but the briefcase is such a beautiful thing to me because it's, you know, because, you know, there's like this, you know, the idea that, I mean, the premise of that particular Cordova film
mm-hmm.
was that it's from the point of view of a woman, her husband might be murdering little boys
right.
and, you know, and she doesn't know. And the nature of the horror in the film, you know, which we don't get to see, but it's just alluded to, is this building paranoia about, do I know this man? And, and he just gets to look into this briefcase, which also in a postmodern way calls back to the briefcase in Pulp Fiction,
mm-hmm.
which contains God knows what, but it's this MacGuffin.
Something.
Yes,
yeah.
And which itself is a quote of the briefcase in Kiss Me Deadly, the My Camera film from the 50s, where it contains like the apocalypse, basically. But
maybe it's the Lost Ark.
Yeah, totally. The Ark of the Covenant, basically. Right. And but in Cordova's world, it's just we can imagine this actor in this film, Thumbscrew. The film is never going to render a verdict one way or the other to whether he is a killer. But this actor gets to look into this briefcase containing bloody clothes and the artifacts that evoke his murder. So
that he was the murderer of children.
Right. And so someone watching the film, like, they're going to get the vibration.
They see that in the actor's eyes. You actually do see that. When the actor knows it, you'll know it. That's how that works.
Right. Yeah.
But do you know?
Well,
think you see it.
Yes. Well, right? and that's why, I mean, Cordova is the idea of a director, not like in the like shorthand sketch of a director, but he's what we want a director to be. Like that idea of Kubrick, like kind of basically kidnapping people and keeping them on his estate. I mean, you know, it's the fabulation, the most hyperbolic view of what making a film would be like, where you brainwash all the actors into their roles, you eliminate all, you know, connections to
or
the outside
Apocalypse
world.
Apocalypse Now. Did you see that?
Heart of Darkness. Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
God. With Sheen and how they filmed that. There's this documentary on it that's devastatingly
good. Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyway, similar idea.
No, totally. Well, and you can watch that film as Cordova goes to Vietnam.
Well, and there's even yet another layer of depth to that, because is Cordova killing children?
Right.
This is something that McGrath finds out on his journey.
Right.
That there's something about Ashley Cordova's soul belongs to the devil.
Yeah, Cordova has gotten himself all wrapped up in this sort of like backcountry Satan worship with these Lovecraftian hillbilly occultists.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and then
this
is
all in one book, people.
One book,
and it's really captivating.
They're getting ready to call upon the devil, and there's this defrocked priest, the spider, who like lures Ashley out. And she can't, you know, there's this, they can't cross the bridge or the devil owns your soul.
That's like
he tricks Ashley into crossing the bridge.
Right.
And so then there's this sort of family mythology that the devil is coming for Ashley.
Right. And we get this in snippets in a way that we don't know whether to believe it or not.
Right.
And then we also get in snippets that perhaps Cordova is gathering artifacts from children and perhaps sacrificing children, there's missing children involved in the whole backstory, and that just really adds to the dread.
Right, that the deep, dark secret about Cordova is that he's trying to convince the devil to take another child's soul in Ashley's
instead
place.
Of his daughter's.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, but McGrath, in relation to all these suggestions of really deep iniquity and evil, is that housewife whose husband comes home with the briefcase. And, you know, and okay, so we've talked about the madness of Cordova. We talked about the struggles of McGrath. But Ashley is really the center of this thing.
Ashley Cordova. It is her apparent suicide that starts the book.
Yes. She is the beautiful, haunted daughter of Cordova.
Piano prodigy.
Yes.
She seemed to, in retrospect, have a lot of the characteristics of the young Marisha Kessel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting wrinkle.
Cultured.
Yes.
And with
overachieving parents, you know, who are nonetheless very attentive in inundating her with all sorts of culture.
I'm just saying, Marisha.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing with Ashley is her journey is, her post-mortem journey, like the journey we go on learning about her, is almost the reverse of McGrath. Like her death sort of starts this, is infused with the sense of menace. You think she has gone through something horrible. There's all of these implications of the horrors that she suffered at the hands of her father. And then it just comes like stepping back. And there's the final reveal that her time in the mental hospital was not being treated for being psychologically broken. She is actually undergoing chemotherapy because she has
incurable leukemia.
And you don't know, like,
no,
is,
you
is
don't
that
know
true?
Well, you know, and I think even before that point, even before that reveal, because the thing is, in the beginning of the book, she's such a ghostly figure, in the same way, you know, everyone seems to like symbolize something rather than necessarily being like fully fleshed and nuanced themselves in the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But as we go, I mean, what breaks her in as an actual person, you know, mm-hmm. that we emotionally connect with is seeing her through the eyes of Hopper,
mm-hmm.
who, and also, and he becomes human when, you know, at first he sort of knew her maybe.
Like,
and,
oh, we spent some time at camp together.
Yeah.
It was a weird, like, high pressure camping situation where everyone was sort of tortured.
Right. The,
right, yeah,
the bad kid camp.
Yeah.
The, like,
yeah,
quintessential,
yeah,
bad kid camp.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
That's, yeah, like a Hanoi death march through the California,
yeah,
desert. It
uh-huh.
does not sound fun.
No.
It's not
it
fun
not.
Camping.
Not at all.
Yeah.
But how else are kids going to learn?
Right.
You know?
Right.
But, and, like, when we realize how much she meant to him,
yeah,
he is humanized, but more importantly,
mm-hmm,
yes,
yeah,
she is humanized.
Right.
And,
in
right,
being able to care for somebody like that, and being,
yeah,
vulnerable enough.
Right, right,
that
right.
Is, that's it.
Well,
and she
and
has broken his heart and left him because she goes, she is in remission for a long period of time, and
mm-hmm,
then her leukemia resurfaces, and
mm-hmm,
she does not want him to be the boy with the doomed girlfriend who
right.
dies. So
right.
instead, she wants to be the ice bitch who broke his heart.
Right,
right,
right.
And completely...
But it's already too late.
Right.
Because, I mean, you know, like, the book is defined by her absence. All these characters are defined by the hole she's left in their life. But when he starts talking about what it was like to be alone with her,
yeah,
and what it was like to know her, then we miss her too.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And,
finally.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, come on. She's like you, the, okay, come on. Is she not like the paragon of girlhood? She's like brilliant,
yeah,
kind of crazy, real pretty.
Yep.
Really understands people, is able to manipulate all of these poor
is super
suckers,
rich.
Is super rich.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's, she does not become like that parent, you know, she's like this goddess, but until
human,
she becomes,
yeah,
vulnerable,
yeah,
right,
she's like untouchable.
Well, you know, the artwork and the photography in the book there, I mean, we actually get to see photographs,
mm-hmm,
of Ashley and stuff,
right,
and it's very well done and it's beautifully done, but I, for me, this Argento book was just added this beautiful extra layer.
Oh,
because
she'd be a companion.
Well, it should be indeed. Yeah, because Asia Argento, it, like, to me, like, casting her in my head as,
mm-hmm,
that person, and Asia Argento is alive and kicking and does not have leukemia and is not...
That we know
that
of.
That we know of, yes. Knock wood. But a, like, just a, you know, someone, like, you know, wise beyond her years. I saw an interview with her where she was talking about her relationship to Dario,
uh-huh,
her dad, and she was saying... It has occurred to me that sometimes that my father only had me, so he would have an actress to torture in his films, where he would not have to, you know, feel responsible for it because he owns me, because I come from him.
Oh my
God. And that's okay with me.
Wow. Wow. Where does that come from? You know, is that a cultural thing? Is that a family thing?
Yeah.
A filmmaking artistic thing?
All of the above, I guess. But,
I mean,
but also it's not like Asia appreciates art because, you know, she has a daddy complex and
right,
her daddy
right.
is an artist. It's like she recognizes that her father is an artist. She has, it like, an art complex.
Well, and it's kind of...
Or she has daddy issues that then translate into art because that's what her daddy does.
Okay, it's all of the above.
It's all
magical. That's
what
we're...
What
right.
are you saying,
Chris? Particle and a wave.
But what I'm... No, but the thing...
Yes.
The leukemia story, as much as that, frustrated me because...
I didn't want it to be that simple, frankly.
Well, I didn't either. But then at the same time, I kind of fell in love with that particular
tragic,
twist
yeah.
so hard because it redeems Cordova, and I
yeah.
really wanted Cordova to be redeemed because
guy.
The implication is that, you know, that he is sort of, he's a filmmaker, he gets all these resources, he's living sort of his dream,
mm-hmm.
and then his daughter gets sick, and so, you know, he stops his work, he crafts this whole mythology about, you know, her being on the run from the devil and him protecting her,
right.
and, you know, fully just kind of delves into this in order to provide her with something greater than this, what is like ultimately this tragic, fucked up, unstoppable thing
that
he cannot buy his way out of.
No amount
of
money or talent or it has any power to fix. Right. Or change.
And it's almost like that thing where, I mean, when you're engaged in a lifetime of creating art, and I think you'll hear anecdotes from the life of any artist who seems to be as committed as Cordova is,
mm-hmm.
where, like, things start manifesting in your life that reflect your art.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. it's like someone...
And vice versa.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You start, like, willing
everything
things into
being. Everything you see
yeah.
becomes part of your art. And this sort of mixing up of the art and the life
uh-huh.
is a big characteristic of Cordova's world.
And it's his ethic. I mean, he's basically, he's created this environment where him, his family, his circle, and whoever his crew and cast is in the shooting of a particular film, they have this... They get to live this ritualized, marvelous, epiphanic experience.
I think the boundary between
reality and art is completely shredded.
It's one and the same thing. And this, I mean, that's when you brought up Asia Argento. I'm thinking of this because, you know, it's in her DNA.
Yeah.
This is part of who she is.
Right, right, right.
And so, she's going to be that way.
Yeah.
And yes, Ashley's going to be that way.
Right, indeed.
Or at least Cordova hopes she is.
But that's the thing. For him to make his career and this whole magical path of his to go so boldly into darkness mm-hmm. and yet to be living this charmed life where everyone's kind of haunted, people are haunted. But it's almost like when she gets sick, that's, you know, like that, like he, that is him being called to account. Oh, it's almost like the universe saying, oh, you think you know about darkness?
Here's darkness.
Here's
and his
the
films,
thing.
His
yes.
films are about going through that darkness and coming to the end. And they're not about answering anything.
Right.
There's no limits to anything.
Right. So it's a challenge because he wants to fix it. You know? I mean, he wants to fix this in a very un-Cordova fashion.
Yeah.
Right.
You know? Like, this would not happen in his films, him trying to get her better.
No.
Right.
You know? In his films, he just wants to explore everything to the end.
Yeah, and almost Ashley goes through that journey against his will. Like, he has her... She's in the hospital. She's undergoing chemotherapy, maybe. But the implication is that she's undergoing chemotherapy, and she escapes because she doesn't want to be the girl. You know, just like with Hopper, she doesn't want to be the girl who wastes away and dies.
Right.
So she runs away. She hangs out in the East Village.
She lives in this weird flat above the
Asian grocery market, and then like breaks into the piano store, plays like five amazing concerts in the middle of the empty piano store, and then throws herself down an elevator shaft.
Right.
Because she doesn't want to be the girl, you know, and dies of leukemia. And she doesn't want to be the girl whose dad is trying to save her from leukemia. She wants to be
her own
meta girl. You know,
she wants to be I think she doesn't want to be a meta girl. She wants to be a real girl, you know?
Aww.
And, you know, because...
Like Pinocchio.
Pinocchio, indeed. This is, and her, her barbed soul gets longer when it's barbed.
And, you know, it should be enough. It's enough for Hopper. It satisfies his Romeo complex about Ashley, the leukemia.
Sure.
And it satisfies Nora. For Nora, that explains everything that she has seen.
Which is appropriate since they're the Nancy Drews, right?
Right, but not McGrath. That's the point where McGrath leaves the Scooby Gang behind.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And really gets down deep. And that kind of brings us to this Inez Gallo, the character they have hinted at. But
Coyote.
Yes, the Coyote.
Oh, yeah. His main aide, right? Cordova is like assistant in all things.
Right, right. Conductor, messenger of
the god.
Yeah,
and
the
one that ushers people across the border in Mexico.
Right,
right.
And also
yes.
like this trickster figure who sort of cleans up his dirty work and is almost like... his border figure.
Is setting traps, you know, and so Coyote figure in the Native American, like, you know, trickster god
sort of
sense.
Right.
But also Hermetic, she's the Hermes figure and that he is the lofty Zeusy godhead of his personal universe. And she is his messenger, kind of conducts and sews things up. And she's also a crossroads figure because McGrath, you know, kind of like meets her at these thresholds into of hell or the world of Cordova.
Right.
You know, she's this sort of interface between like, you know, reality.
Very literary.
Indeed. Well, and it's a book. And you know,
I'm talking about you, Jason.
I'm a book.
Don't be so modest.
And so, and she guards that gateway, and so she's sort of like Hermes Psychopompos, and that is a facet of Hermes that conducts souls to the underworld.
Okay.
And takes spirits back from time to time, depending.
Like, well, and she forces. So she did all these things. It's like she explains Ashley was sick. And then she was getting treatments, and that corresponds with all those weird times, right? And then Cordova was that old man in the institution, right?
Right.
In the nursing home.
I love that.
Oh, yeah, because you're going, wow, he's really gone.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Or is he not? Because
well, and we find out that that's not the case, but it's like she...
It's in one of the, like, 17 endings.
Well, and that brings to mind something that, that was... beautiful to me in the book was McGrath's journey from like as the sort of supernatural stuff in the story, in Ashley's story, the supernatural facets of her death, just the supernatural facets of Cordova's world. As those things start to suggest themselves, McGrath is almost annoying in his resistance to those things.
Yeah,
he is so like dialectical materialist, like that's just bullshit.
And doesn't Beckman tell him he gives him the out basically. He says, oh, she had leukemia.
Or, right, yeah, yes. And right? So in that Coyote that kind of makes sense of stuff. Yeah. Yes. And but it's almost like what when he's gone through this whole experience, especially like the Hellfire initiation of actually storming the estate and rampaging through this like microcosm, this collage of all of Cordova's like self-made universes as he's rampaging through these sets and he comes out the other side.
Right.
All that stuff is cast into doubt and he's like, maybe that stuff is true. And he's let the supernatural like crash into his headspace and it's completely like upended his sense of self, and he's gone on this journey that a character goes through in a Cordova
movie.
Right,
and that's when he circles back to Beckman. Beckman, the Cordova scholar
who he had seen at the beginning.
Right, it's like a contact of his when he's initially sort of investigating Cordova years before that destroyed his career. And Beckman, he comes to Beckman, he's distraught, he's like, I'm living in a Cordova film. Nothing makes sense anymore. And he wants to know, what are the fucking rules.
Yeah.
And Beckman lays out for him all of these sort of tropes and characters that are unique to the Cordova film.
Yeah.
And he...
The little symbols
within. The characters eating raw meat and the specific brand of cigarettes.
Oh,
and,
right.
Right. And he...
Well, because he has a different cat named for every little symbol, right?
Right. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And he tells him that Cordova's favorite character is...
Are you reading from the book?
I can. Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts because I think it totally sums up his encounter with Inez, with the Coyote.
Right.
Often at some point in a Cordova narrative, the hero encounters a character who is life and death itself. He or she will be sitting at the intersection of the two, the beginning of one, the end of the other. Hmm. It will be a decoy, a substitute to grant freedom to the real thing. So Inez is like, shows him the Cordova, like, proxy in the hospital, and is like, here, you can take this. You can take this, that this was all a farce. This was all about Ashley's leukemia and a totally crazy director trying to make it make sense within his own mythology.
Right.
Or...
You can have the truth.
You can have the truth.
Right? Well, but I feel like she hands that to him, and she's saying, here's what you want. Here's what's going to make sense of this.
Here's the solution, which is what McGrath seems to be pursuing.
Yeah, but she's not offering him another option. But he, because of the journey that he has made, he can't accept that. Yeah. Because he's seen, like, a bigger view of what's possible in a human life because of his contact.
He's become one of those people who has been in a Cordova film,
who emerges
totally changed. Every actor that's ever been in a Cordova film comes out a different person.
Well, right, and it seemed like for a minute that he was going to take it, right? There's, like, the leukemia.
This is another one of those endings.
And then Nora is the 19-year-old... Yes. Scooby at Kochet girl is throwing herself at him in the middle of the night, and I'm so frustrated. Please don't fuck her. Please don't let this be, oh, your wife left you for a man with actual abdominal muscles, and so you had
this
kooky adventure, and then you shacked up with a 19-year-old.
Okay, this might be a bit of a stretch to me. That seemed to be another, like, like call out to like something in the genre, that was like the girl with the dragon tattoo. Because to me,
right.
that's the oh, thing that doesn't quite work in that story.
Okay, right. But Nora is no Lisbeth Salander.
No, she isn't. Right. Yes.
And what I love
and
about
McGrath is no what's his face?
Yeah, right. And I hate those books anyway. After I read the interview where he said that that was supposed to be a grown-up Pippi Longstocking after she had finally gotten absorbed.
Yeah,
into the
don't.
System.
Yeah,
oh my
don't,
God,
don't
no,
even
that makes
go
me
there.
Love them. I'm gonna go back.
The
I
only
take
thing
everything
I
back.
Love about that is because in the remake, he's played by the James Bond guy. Who's
oh
so
yes.
Oh,
right. Oh yeah. No, it makes sense. Of her,
the American version.
Yeah, the American. They're both pretty good, actually. The movies a little bit torture porn, but. Anyway, let's get back to
it's
what
not
we're talking about.
Necessarily a bad thing, yes.
Torture
but,
porn?
Yeah.
Jason, you're killing me.
Okay,
where we were. Nora's throwing herself at McGrath, Inez
right.
Gallo, the proxy Cordova in the hospital.
Right. There was the thing where his daughter, Sam, he's got this daughter with his ex-wife, and he thinks all his problems are because his ex-wife left him for this bodybuilder. Well, no, this perfect man.
Uh-huh.
And she doesn't trust him with their kid, Sam, anymore. And mm-hmm. so there's this fraught relationship.
And there's also all of this implied imminent menace to Sam throughout the book, which totally
right?
killed me too, right?
Oh, it's brutal. If you have a kid, it'll kill you.
Right.
But then it turns out Sam knew Ashley.
Right.
And wasn't it how did he
or,
figure
or
that
met
out?
Met her, didn't know her, but
she, no,
met
she
her.
Met
yeah,
her, but
right.
but Ashley gave her something, and
right.
he asks his daughter, "What was she like? What was Ashley like?"
Yeah,
and his daughter says, "She was magical."
Yes, and this is a breakthrough, like I think for him, and a breakthrough into that world of the supernatural because he. You know, is so steeped and jaded and conflicted in his relationship with other people, with his wife, with her
right.
husband, with, and, you know, I think with anybody who's, you know, been a bit, you know, chafed by life,
right.
you know, the children in your life are like arbiters of honesty
mm-hmm.
and like an unmitigated, unfiltered reality. And to hear, you know, that his daughter, like brushed up against this person, despite this kind of reductive view
right.
of Ashley's history.
Right.
She had leukemia. She was just a messed up girl, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Fucked
yeah.
up by her insane
Maybe.
Father.
Maybe.
Yes. And that there's, you can read the facts of the matter in a way where that story makes sense.
Yeah.
But there's also this other thing. And with her unfiltered view, his daughter saw her and saw a magical being.
A magical
and that's
thing.
True too.
Well, it's, and that, I mean, that, draws back to the very first time we hear about her, their life on the estate, all of that stuff. And what's really cool about what that contributes to McGrath is he wants the truth.
Yeah.
He's written all these true crime stories. You know, this is the solution to this case. It's all explainable. But this is the one that brings him into this sort of the real truth, which we all know, which is that the world is kind of magical, and you cannot explain everything. And I'm not saying I can sit here and levitate, and you should believe me. I'm saying there are things you can't explain in a beautiful,
yeah.
human way.
And I think, you know, Cordova's fictional fans, the reason that this book was so effective at what it was attempting to do to, like, beguile us and terrify us at the same time
right.
is that Cordova's films, the truths that are revealed by Cordova's films are completely subjective.
Right.
Like
right.
you cannot package them and sell them, which is why
right.
they'll never be commercially successful. And
right.
some of them are completely unavailable.
Right.
And the actors have never seen them.
Right.
Because for them, it was not about making a film. By the end, it was about the journey.
Right.
Well,
which is why,
yeah.
like the ultimately for McGrath, the leukemia story is not enough because
right.
if it's not about Ashley,
right.
if it's not about rescuing her post-mortem, then these guys are just useless,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Like, in the face of Ashley's leukemia, Hopper's bad boy thing doesn't work anymore. He, like, gives up dealing drugs and he just wants to go find his mother and go settle down.
Right.
And, you know, and what is McGrath doing? You know,
right.
if he's not
yeah.
figuring out the deep, dark truth about Ashley, then he's got no role at all.
Well, it's the for me, the beautiful part is in the whole truth thing. McGrath wants the truth.
Uh-huh.
Cordova because of what he has been through. And we know he's been through something, whether or not it's the straight leukemia story, whether it's the straight occult story, whether it's some mixture of the two.
Right.
Cordova, he wants the real truth. And we all know, as people, as deep down in ourselves, we know the real truth is unknowable.
Well, and that it's not a journalistic truth. Yeah. It supersedes
you
the facts.
You can't package
the facts
it. Exactly.
Only can we suggest. Like,
well, and different points
experience.
Of view. You, Jason, me, Kat, you, Christy, we'd all have a different point of view of the same events. Mm-hmm. But it's still true. And so McGrath will never be that guy again.
Right.
To think that he can solve something. To think that's the be all end all.
Yeah, no, indeed.
It's like when he comes out of the estate. Yeah, right. He comes out of the estate with three objects. He comes out with the bone and the bloody shirt,
right,
and the compass, and the bone turns out to be like a bear's foot.
Yeah,
and the bloody shirt is
corn syrup.
Right. So he takes them to the police and they analyze them, and he's just furious because it's like it's almost like it doesn't matter what they're made of.
Right.
They are symbols.
Yeah.
Right. And regardless of what your tests show, something happened.
Right. But in his insistence on that, he has been inveigled into a world of signs and symbols.
Right.
He's beyond the reach of journalism.
Right.
His need for these things to mean something means that all of his paradigms have been smashed. He has had the Cordova experience.
Yeah.
Which brings him to an ending where he is not satisfied by the Occam's razor most reasonable view of what all this meant. That it a daughter with leukemia leading to a shell-shocked wreck of an old man who's Cordova in a nursing home.
Maybe.
Right, because that's not a hero's journey. That's not revelatory. It is not, transportive in any
way.
It's
reductive. Right. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
It's a tragedy.
Right.
And his, God knows, the ending is so ambiguous and takes us to that place of the unknowable. Like, it really, it's like this, almost this ellipsis where he doesn't accept the nursing home.
Right.
Shattered Cordovia paradigm.
Right.
And so he goes beyond and is led a bit further into this mystery and gets to confront this godlike figure on the threshold of God knows what revelation. Cordova is going to tell his truth, and we are denied that.
Yeah, because once McGrath hears that truth, once McGrath has completed that journey, he doesn't live here anymore.
Right.
We can't even understand what he has.
Because he's transformed.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, and that Cordova, what Cordova has to impart. I mean, you get the impression that Cordova, at some point in his shadowy prehistory, and perhaps this aspect of his backstory is known in specifics to Marisha Pessl, or perhaps, perhaps not. But
maybe it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Ashley's implied backstory. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Well, Cordova had some dark epiphany in his past. We don't know the nature of it.
Well, there are so many possibilities. His Italian beautiful model wife dying.
Yeah.
His daughter having leukemia.
Yeah, you see like
upbringing with his mother.
Right,
yeah.
You see a sequence
of
dark epiphanies where it's almost like you can imagine Cordova as, oh, I have seen the truth.
Because his childhood is explicated vaguely in the book.
Right.
As this immigrant, who doesn't mix with anyone,
Well, it's almost like at any point I could have experienced an archetypal tragedy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Pick one. It doesn't matter. Let's move from there.
Yeah. Well, I think, I've experienced this. I've seen the truth. I've seen the nature of things. So I'm going to proceed, according to the dictates of this dark truth. And then encountering another dark truth.
Right.
Oh, wait a second. That wasn't true at all.
That wasn't dark. It's dark now.
Not dark enough.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And the way we're talking about this, listeners, it makes it sound like this is a really heavy story. It's really, wow, there's these universal truths, which there are.
Yes.
But it's totally captivating. It's really fun to read the bits of the. Well, you've read it probably.
It's
so
a romp. It's a giddy romp.
It was a dark, terrifying, subjective truth kind of romp.
It's a quantum romp through the shadowy hinterlands of human consciousness and film history, and the lives of these tormented characters.
Yeah,
who are all refractions of our darkest selves.
Wow, Jason, that's deep.
Oh, yes. So, All right. Okay. So the end, I feel like we've addressed the ending. Do you have any additional comments, ladies? About
we were
how
talking
you think
earlier.
Should
you were
out?
Saying something about them having. They could talk because they had been together through some experience. What was it you had said?
Who could talk? Who?
Christy. That Cordova and McGrath.
Yes.
Theoretically.
Oh,
oh
right.
Yes. Like
it's
their
like
conversation.
He had to. Yeah. Right. His, you can imagine that conversation. Like,
yeah.
It's almost like Cordova had to build the his companion. Like,
well,
he had to drag someone through all this.
Yeah.
Right.
He was worthy enough to not take that threshold out.
Right.
Who would, he would then be able to kind of sit. Like,
oh, and isn't that interesting? So possibly he chose McGrath.
Well, I
because
feel like
McGrath,
I mean,
had been the one at the beginning who
right.
was onto something.
Well,
yeah.
McGrath chasing him, it's almost like Cordova, you know, is
who
like, oh, okay,
who?
Someone wants to know my truth.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you are not fit
you
to sit with me. You
truth.
Can't handle my truth.
It's
so I'm going
imitation.
To build
yes. yeah.
this
right.
machine disguised as your life
mm-hmm.
that is going to process you into being someone who can sit with me and understand.
Which is like a Cordova
the only
movie.
Truth I know, yes.
Right, which is why it's so confusing for McGrath, because the,
he doesn't know he's in a movie.
This story mm-hmm. starts 5 years before this story starts, where McGrath
yeah, yeah.
kind of encounters
false
this lead.
Beginnings, false
yeah, there's
endings.
This lead on Cordova that
mm-hmm.
maybe he might be onto the deep, dark secret about Stanislaw Cordova.
Mm-hmm.
And this brief interaction with the world of Cordova discredits him as a journalist,
mm-hmm.
destroys his career,
right.
destroys his ego, which leads to the downfall of his marriage.
Right.
And proceeds this, like...
Which wasn't good enough for him, because...
Decline
yeah.
that ultimately leads him to, when Ashley dies, that snippet.
Or when she, before that, when she appears to him
right.
at the reservoir. Did Cordova set that
Park,
up?
Right.
Was Ashley in on the whole
well,
thing?
Well, but, okay, but she's marking McGrath, because this, it's like the passage of Inanna or Ishtar, one of the oldest, like, possible myths of her passage into the underworlds to encounter the great revolution, the engine of reality itself.
You're over my head, Jason, but I love it.
Okay, she's this Babylonian goddess, like one of the earliest like,
I mean,
conceptions
I think
of goddessness.
And Dustin Hoffman when you say Ishtar, but
okay, yes.
go on.
Okay, yeah, no, a modern degradation. But no, Ishtar, this goddess who
right.
precedes most civilizations that we know about, she wants to know why things die. She wants to know why time. Why is there time?
Good
why
question.
Is there, you know, why can't
me
things
too.
Just exist in a state of constant rapture and ecstasy? And it's a goddess asking this question.
Right.
And she has to go into the underworld, the night side of the mind, to encounter the primal engine, the primal fact, the ultimate unknowable truth. She
yeah.
wants to know it.
Yeah.
And so she goes and she's armed. She's armed with all these powers and artifacts and beautiful facets of her transcendental goddess-like character. And this is what gives her the power and the confidence to step into the zone of the unknowable. And so she goes, and once she crosses that first threshold into the hell world, she realizes that she that stuff is actually weighing her down, that it's getting in the way of her apprehension of the universal truth.
She's thinking too much.
And at each level, she is stripped.
Right.
Those things have to be stripped away for her to
which
know
is,
these things.
Which
your
is,
worldly connection.
And in conclusion,
yes,
that is exactly what this book did for me.
Yes.
I Pat Janowski, have to say that what this book really, where it really resonated for me
mm-hmm.
was exactly that. Stripping away the strata, these
uh-huh.
like invented societal strata, basically,
right.
to... a person needs to live their artistic vision. If they're an artist, we're all writers, so this is kind of how we are, right?
Yeah.
Sorry,
let
we're lost.
Let
causes.
Your wife leave you. Leave the Scooby Gang behind. let Cordova's creepy assistant steal all your notebooks.
Okay,
you
stop
don't
it.
Need
right.
those things.
Christy
okay.
obviously is a literalist. But I'm just talking about it. It makes me
uh-huh.
want to like live more like the Cordova character.
Well, yeah.
Really live, make my art and my life the same thing,
right?
You know, accept it, live it, bring out what's essentially you in your essential core, because
yeah.
that's why you're here.
Well, yeah, and that's a potentially terrifying thing, because
absolutely.
Cordova has made this pact: I want to know the unknowable.
Right.
So in his pursuit of that, he grows a family that can pursue the unknowable with him. Oh, but wait a second, having all these comforts, and all these beautiful, you know, like people
doesn't
who appreciate you.
Doesn't protect you from the inevitable death.
Yes, yeah. And if you want to know that, okay, because you could, it's almost like there may have been a golden moment, perhaps that golden afternoon that the book details, where it seems like a, you know, it's a weekend at the Cobblers and everything's beautiful.
Where Ashley is teaching everyone to oil paint.
Yes.
Down by the lake.
Room with a view.
Oh, I know. It's just beautiful. And it's like, and there may have been, it seems like there was something, you know, not detailed in the book necessarily, but in my head, like something in Cordova's heart, you can stop here and it will be okay. Uh-huh. And you're still important.
Jason. What a great, that's a great interpretation of the thing.
But he, because he is this idea of someone who goes too far, he'd say, okay, I can't stop.
So is
here.
That what the book meant to you? I mean, how would you say your kind of final?
Yeah, no. It took me to a similar place, a scary place where it asks the question, if you want to know the unknowable, are you prepared
for the truth?
Well, yeah, and to let go of whatever beautiful things happen to surface in your pursuit of eternity.
Absolutely. What about you, Christy? What is your kind of takeaway from this book?
I think for me it was to not lose sight of the transformative power of those dark moments, you know, because to greater or lesser degrees, everyone experiences those and is on that journey. Yeah. So when you're in those dark places, just reach in and grab something, like anything, to hold on to until the lights come back on.
Oh, that's nice. No, it's great. I mean, if a book gives us something, those things they're substantial.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And these things, you know, like popped out of a pulp mystery novel. And
well done.
Yes, well done, Marisha Petzl.
Oh, I
well
would not
done.
Call this a pulp mystery.
Pulp is my highest compliment.
Well, right. That's to you. That's you.
Okay. Yes. Okay. So here we are. I think we've wrapped all this up with a golden bow. I think we've had a marvelous discussion. This is a marvelous book, Night Film by Marisha Petzl.
Also the author of Special Topics in Calamity
Physics. Yes, which I have not read, but I want to, because this book is so beautiful. Yes, indeed.
I like physics. That'd be cool.
Right? That'd be cool. That'd be all right. Cool. All right. Some physics. Is that right?
All right. Physics.
And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to Book Circle Online. And for tunneling through the library of Maria Menounos with us, and and discovering all these golden stories. And I am Jason Squamata, and you can tweet me or follow me.
Ooh.
Yes, at SquamataPod on Twitter, and you can friend me on Facebook. It's SQUAMATA.
Squamata.
Or you can send me an email at squamatapod@gmail.com.
Oh, that's so cute.
Okay, Pat, how does one reach you?
I'm less accessible, but you may try to friend me on Facebook, although people have a hard time finding me. Pat Janowski, JanOWSKI. I cannot change my name. It's such a good name.
It's a great name. I know.
Try that, Portland, Oregon, or, a little note saying who you are, always helpful. I love you from Book Circle Online, like that, or I'm going to come over and mow your lawn or do your laundry. That's even better. Or you can find out more about me on my band's website, which is bergerette.com, bergerette.com.
And what a band, Exquisito. Lovely music. Check it out. Christy.
You can listen to my own writings being performed on SoundCloud.
Who are you?
Christy. Yes. KRISTI Lovato, LOVATO. You can also find me on Facebook under the same name. I'm actually not allowed to tweet. I'm hoping that will be overturned shortly. But
is it your daughter?
In
is
the
she
meantime.
Forbidding you?
Uh-huh. No.
Yes.
All right, we'll stop at that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we're not privileged to know. But thank you for tuning in, and please join us in our tireless struggle to keep reading alive. All forms of media are beautiful and are capable of opening endless doors in our beautiful human brains, but there's something extra special about a book, because it's ink blots on a page that our brains decode and turn into endless beautiful brain movies, more beautiful than any movie that could ever be filmed. A book is sheet music for a hallucination. And a jungle of hallucinations. And so let's keep that alive and keep that part of our culture.
Jason.
Yes.
Did you ever know that you're my hero?
Oh, oh God! You two are the wind beneath my wings, Pat Janowski. And yes,
Christy Lovato.
Right. Thank you. And step into the circle next time, where we'll be talking about another fascinating book. And love out to all of you. Stay bookish. Stay circular. Book Circle Online.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.